Lord our God, once again, you grace us with a new day and the gift of life and the gift of each other, and the gift of all those whom we love and all those whom we are yet to meet. We ask that in this day and in this hour, as we study the scriptures, you give us not only eyes to see, but ears to hear the things heavy and otherwise, which are in our own hearts and in the hearts of others and in your own heavy heart full of love for all of us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, the word heavy was in the prayers, and the stuff I'm doing today is in its own way kind of heavy, so I'm going to start with something light. Light bulb jokes. There's not much that's lighter than light bulb jokes, just a few. How many medical students does it take to screw in a light bulb? 5, 1 to screw in the bulb, 4 to yank the ladder out from under him. How many graduate... Bob can tell us. How many graduate students does it take? 1, but it takes 9 years. How many nuclear engineers does it take? 7, 1 to install the new bulb, and 6 to figure out what to do with the old one for the next 10,000 years. A few regional ones. How many New Yorkers does it take? None of your damn business. How many New Jerseyites does it take? 3, 1 to change the bulb, 1 to be a witness, and the 3rd to shoot the witness. I know you've heard these. How many Californians takes 4, 1 to screw in the bulb, and 3 to share the experience of enlightenment? As for Oregonians, it takes 6. 1 to screw in the bulb and 5 to chase off the Californians who have come to share the experience. How many Zen masters does it take? 2. 1 to screw in the bulb and 1 not to screw in the bulb. How many Teamsters do you suppose it takes? Somebody answered last time 20. You got a problem with that? How many psychiatrists does it take? Only 1, but their bulb really has to want to change. How many Marxists? None. The old bulb contains the seeds of its own revolution. Finally, my favorite. How many surrealists does it take to screw in a light bulb? It takes 2. 1 to hold the giraffe and the other to fill the bathtub with brightly colored bicycles. Okay, well, yesterday we were looking at visions of end time feasts, eschatological banquets, and the ones we saw, in particular the central one from Isaiah 25, the one that we'll use tonight again in our theme Vespers for this summer, is a good and true vision, and it is worth repeating over and over and finding ways to have come closer to us. But as we saw in the context of that vision, the biblical authors, just like we ourselves, are not yet at the point where we are able to muster a completely pure image of such things because of the way we still are in our own relationship to others and our, at least at this time yet, inability to have everyone at the same table with us. That vision that we held up yesterday does say that at the end God will wipe away all tears and there will be no more mourning. And today we're going to talk about tears and the immensity of the project of wiping away, handling, listening to all the tears. We're going to begin in a piece of the book of Jeremiah, in the part of Jeremiah that's called the Book of Hope. Most of the book of Jeremiah is not very hopeful. Most of the book of Jeremiah is diatribe and judgment and threat, because that was Jeremiah's call. He was called, according to Jeremiah 1 in his report of this, mostly to pluck up and to break down and overthrow, and only then to build and to plant. In this little book of hope, there lies this text that's the starting point for what I want to work through with you today. Jeremiah 31:15-17. The context is a double destruction. Jeremiah is much concerned in this chapter not only with the destruction of Judah at the hands of the Babylonians in the early part of the 6th century BC, but he's also concerned with the destruction of the northern kingdom a century and a half before at the hands of the Assyrians. The Assyrians had come. They were about as ruthless an empire as I've ever read about in the ancient world. The Assyrians had come and slaughtered at least a third of the people and carted at least another third away. The Babylonians did something fairly similar when they put siege to Jerusalem in the 6th century and for 3 years surrounded the city until the people were reduced to degraded states of humanity in which they did such things as fight over corpses and placentas and hid them from each other so that only the people who knew where they were could eat for the next day or two. And then after living through that, if you can call it living, the Babylonians broke through and did what conquering armies always do. They murdered and raped and plundered the city and left it lying in ruins. And like the Assyrians before them, they took people into exile in large numbers. And the way you did that back then was to strip the people naked and put them on a forced march. You stripped them naked because they were less likely to flee and more likely to stay compliant and in groups. The Hebrew word for going into exile is galah, which is a form of the word to be naked. And marched them away, and one of the roads they marched them on was the road that went past Rachel's tomb. And so Jeremiah reports, I would say that what Jeremiah has done here is he has called Rachel from her grave to weep for the exiles as they go past, and to mourn the loss of the children of Israel. So let's go back and look at the story of Rachel to find out just how powerful and how meaningful are her particular cries and tears. So let's go back, please, to Genesis 29. Uh, Jacob comes to the territory of his his mother and father because he's had to flee for various reasons, having to do with his mother's and his own deception of their father and the stealing of the blessing. And when he comes to that land, he meets Rachel at the well and falls in love with her, enters into negotiation for marriage, betrothal and marriage to her. And as you all know, when the wedding night came, the father, Laban, snuck Leah, her sister, in her older sister, into the tent instead of Rachel. And Jacob did not discover this until the next morning. And until I did the research that I'm sharing with you today, I always figured he deserved what he got because he must not have talked to her. But in any case, I'll share with you another possibility later on. It's important for this whole thing, why he was deceived, or how he was deceived. He then works another 7 years for Rachel, and then is husband to both Leah and Rachel. And in chapter 29, verse 31, we read that when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. The implication is that the Lord, that God is somehow responsible here for the opening of Leah's womb, the closing of Rachel's. Leah's story is sad too. We don't have time to go into this. I ran out of time as it was in the previous session. But she tries to get this man to love her, and he won't. She keeps bearing him children, which makes her think that now he will, but he won't. Finally, she gives up. Meanwhile, Rachel remains barren. And chapter 30, verse 1, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she envied her sister and said to Jacob, "Give me children or I shall die." That's how important this was to her, life and death. Jacob became very angry with Rachel and said, "Am I in the place of God, who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" So she gives her handmaid to Jacob, and he has children by her. But finally, verse 22, then God remembered Rachel, and God heeded her, and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son, and said, "God has taken away my reproach," and she named the child Joseph, saying, "May the Lord add to me another son." Joseph means do it again. And God does it for her again, but not until chapter 35. Lots of stuff intervenes between the birth of Joseph and chapter 35, verse 16. They happened to be traveling at this particular time. And the narrator tells us in 35:16, then they journeyed from Beth-El, and when they were still some distance from Ephrath, Rachel was in childbirth, and she had hard labor. When she was in her hard labor, the midwife said to her, "Do not be afraid, for now you will have another son." As her soul was departing, for she died, she named the child Ben-Oni, which means son of my sorrow. But his father called him Ben-Yamin, which means son of the right hand or son of favor. So Rachel died, and she was buried on the way to Ephrath. that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar at her grave. It is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day and still is true. Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. So this woman who said, "Give me children or I shall die," lives through and dies amidst the strange irony that the answer to her prayer kills her. And in some ways, just as sad is the fact that she names this second child for her sorrow, Ben-Oni, and her husband does not let the name stand and silences the voice of her sorrow by the lifting of that name and gives him a different name instead, taking away her voice, silencing her tears and her mourning. Who'd want to go around with the name Son of My Sorrow? On the other hand, she died that that child might live. And the voice of the sorrow that she would never see her child grow to be a man or a people is silenced. And it's that voice that Jeremiah calls from the tomb 1,000 years later, when the offspring of her two children have now been murdered. In the destruction of Judah, the people of Benjamin would have been destroyed. And 150 years before, her other child's offspring, Joseph doesn't have a tribe name for him, but one of Joseph's sons was Ephraim. And Ephraim became the dominant tribe of the northern kingdom. And those people were slaughtered by the Assyrians. And so now both of Rachel's children are destroyed. And that's why Jeremiah calls her from her grave to mourn the loss of the children that she died giving birth to. The impact, the full impact, and a little kind of secret that's embedded into these verses of Jeremiah is revealed, at least to me, in some Jewish literature that I have been investigating in the last few months. And most of it is in a book that I have with me and that I have recommended that the bookstore buy, and there are a bunch of copies over in the bookstore. This book called Rachel by Samuel Dresner, who's a at least part of the time teaches at Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. This is a study of the whole Rachel tradition, both in the scriptures and in Judaism. And to me, it's become very enlightening about not only some things in the Hebrew Bible, but some tangents of that, I believe, appear, or if they are not tangents, they are at least closely related things in the New Testament and in the Christian tradition. And they offer some very practical ways for us to think about some things in our own time. The figure of Rachel becomes very important for various reasons, and one of the reasons is because, and I don't understand, I don't happen to know why certain lessons are read on Jewish festivals and in the Jewish lectionary tradition, because I've never studied Jewish lectionary traditions. But Jeremiah 31 is one of the readings for the second day of Rosh Hashanah. And that's part of the penitential season between the New Year and the Day of Atonement, the High Holy Days as they are known. And so the figure of Rachel gets great attention during this time and is the central figure. And some midrashes have sprung up around this text in Jeremiah 31. A midrash is an inquiry. The word midrash means inquiry. Into a text, and specifically, it's an investigation of a mystery or an unanswered question or some gap that's in a text. And there is a very fascinating midrash tradition that's grown up around Jeremiah 31, 15-17, and the business of Rachel here. And I'm going to summarize this particular thing because it's quite lengthy, and there are several versions of it. But the midrash goes like this. Some midrashes are in effect, fictional narratives that spin off from a biblical text that answer a question that the biblical text raises. Some of them are just commentaries or notes on things. But this one is a narrative. At the time that the temple is destroyed by the Babylonians, God comes to Jerusalem, to the ruins, to mourn the loss of the people and to mourn the destruction of the temple. And because the place is so desolate and barren, God wants someone to come mourn with God. And so God calls Moses from Moses' grave and says, Moses, actually God sends angels to the grave of Moses. And the angels who are guarding Moses' grave say, why do you want to bother Moses? It takes three times before Moses finally agrees to come. Moses asks God, what do you want? And God says, mourn with me for the loss of the temple. And Moses says, mourn with you? It's your fault. You could have stopped this, and you didn't. You brought us across the Red Sea. Why didn't you save Jerusalem? Why should I mourn with you? God says, okay. God's used to this from Moses. God says, okay, get Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob out here. So they get Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's a wonderful thing in the Jewish tradition how you can call people from their graves. And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are no better than Moses. You know, they don't get in God's face the way Moses did, but, you know, all they can think of is, well, why did this have to happen, you know? Whose fault is this? And finally, up steps Rachel. And Rachel just weeps. And she doesn't blame. And finally she says, well, God, remember the night I was to have been married. And my father decided to put Leah in the tent. Do you know how heartbroken I was? But do you remember how to protect my sister from Jacob's anger and jealousy, that I snuck into the tent and under the bed, and every time Jacob spoke to Leah, I answered, so that he would hear my voice and not know. And if I could contain my jealousy, God, and do that for my sister, you can contain your jealousy over the people's idolatries and save Israel. And in that midrash, God says, okay, there is a future for your children. I'll bring them back. what the Midrash tries to say, or tries to answer, is why, in response to Rachel's mourning, God says, okay, I'll bring them back. What's different about Rachel's tears from all the other prayers and all the other prophetic responses to the tragedy that's happened? And I take that Midrash to have, you know, I mean, Rachel's tears are given two kinds of force in that Midrash. First of all, they are tears that don't blame. And secondly, she simply holds up an example of a purity of whatever the opposite of jealousy is. And God says, that's right. I don't need to be jealous, and I will save. And so Rachel has a place in Jewish tradition much more important than I ever imagined until I started probing this and discovered that in some elements of Jewish theology, she has a place not unlike Elijah's. Most of us know about Elijah's place, you know, that Elijah is sort of this patron saint type character who's on call. And we remember how in the Passion narrative, when Jesus says, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, some people think he's calling for Elijah, which people did in moments of extremity. But Rachel plays a similar role in the tradition as intercessor on behalf of those who suffer and on behalf of those who mourn. And in some Jewish traditions, in some writings about her, there is even some wordplay on her name, which is rather astonishing, and I think maybe even has some. I'll get to that later. This is what her name looks like in Hebrew. Hebrew does not use vowels. This is the English equivalent: Resh, Chei, Lamed, Rachel. This is how you would say her name. And these are the vowels. Excuse me, that you add by means of pointing in later centuries so that people can pronounce it who don't have it memorized. But because the vowels are not there in Hebrew, it's easy enough to add new vowels and have wordplay on her name and to add these vowels instead of these vowels and then have Ruach El. And Ruach, it means spirit, and El is God. And so she is the voice of the Ruach El, the Spirit of God. Because I probably won't remember to do this because I didn't last time, I want to connect this to a piece of Christian tradition right now. Ahead of time, we speak, along with Paul in Romans 8 in the Christian tradition, of moments. And he's talking about moments of suffering in Romans 8 when we just don't know how to pray in those moments. And in our inability to have a clue as to how to pray in those moments, Paul says, the Ruach El, the Spirit of God, sighs for us with groanings deeper than words. Well, that in Jewish tradition they attribute to Rachel as Spirit of God interceding on behalf of those whose mournings are so deep they are beyond words. There's one other piece of Jewish tradition that I want to share with you, and that is a messianic vision. It's not exactly a feast vision, but it's a vision of the world being set right by the Messiah. And it's in something called the Zohar, which is much later than the rise of Christianity, but its origins are, we don't know exactly when this kind of thinking took place. Except I left out where my page number was. I'll summarize the majority of this vision and then read the last part. The Messiah, when the Messiah comes, the Messiah will lift up his eyes in paradise and behold the patriarchs visiting the ruins of God's sanctuary. He will see Mother Rachel with tears upon her face, refusing to be comforted by the Holy One, blessed be he. Then will the Messiah raise his voice and weep. The righteous and the saints lament with him. Pangs of travail will overtake the people of Israel, and all nations will rage against her. And then begins a sequence of things that are taken from prophecies of various kinds, like Zechariah and Isaiah 2 and elsewhere, where the conclusion of all this will result in warfare conducted by the Messiah, who will take care of all the surrounding nations and will finally vindicate Israel and Jerusalem. And this is the warfare kind of stuff that I was talking about yesterday, which is still a part of some of these traditions. In any case, when this is all concluded, after 12 months of battle, the Messiah will be carried up to heaven in a pillar of fire. And when he descends, the pillar of fire will again be visible to the eyes of the world, and the Messiah will reveal himself, and then it will be time for the Messiah to be crowned. And the Messiah will be crowned in this vision with the crown that God will take off of God's own head, the one with which God first adorned God's self at the time that the Israelites crossed the Red Sea. In that great saving event, God will now take this crown and put it on the Messiah. But where shall the crowning be? Is the final question in the vision. Where shall this be? Answer, on the way to Ephrath, at the crossroads, which is Rachel's grave. To Mother Rachel, he will bring glad tidings, and he will comfort her. And now she will let herself be comforted, and she will rise up and kiss him. So where else would we inaugurate the new age of the Messiah except at Rachel's grave? Not in Jerusalem, but out at Rachel's grave. So that the new age is in effect a response, not to something in Jerusalem, but to the purity of those tears. Well, we have this carried on, of course, in Christian tradition. Matthew could have, but chose not to, tell the story of the Messiah as he, the coming of the Messiah as he understood it, without reference to Rachel, but he made Rachel's tears an integral part of his story. In Matthew 1, we have Joseph notified about the nature of the child that his betrothed is bearing. He marries her. Wise men, magi, come from the east to try to find this child. They go to Jerusalem, where they meet up with Herod and all of Jerusalem in great trouble with him over such news. And as we all know, one of the things Herod does in response to this news is to go out in verses 16 and following of chapter 2. Realizing he'd been tricked by the wise men, he sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had learned from the wise men. So another slaughter in the territory of Rachel's tomb, out there near Bethlehem. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing in loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children, She refused to be consoled because they are no more. So Matthew cannot tell the story of the coming of the Messiah without also recalling Rachel's tears. This Herod had killed most of his own children as well. He was so eager not to have anyone supplant him during his lifetime. The Romans had a saying about Herod. It was in Greek, but I'll give it to only partly in Greek. Better to be Herod's hus than Herod's huius. Hus is pig, huius is son. Slight iota difference. Better to be one of Herod's pigs than one of Herod's sons. He treats the pigs better. The arrival of Jesus is met with murderous slaughter. Or the birth of Jesus, excuse me, is met with that. And once again, in the neighborhood of Rachel's tears, in the neighborhood of Rachel's tomb, we have things for which Rachel weeps. I can't demonstrate in any way that Matthew knew any of these traditions of Judaism that I was sharing with you. But it does seem to me now more a certain richness or a certain fullness to his doing this in this way that I never understood before, now that I realize how important Rachel is in the Jewish tradition and how the Messianic age is in some ways in Judaism a response to this kind of grief. I've discovered in some Christian theology some other things that have picked up on Rachel in recent times, which I find very useful and which I think kind of launch us into a way to use Rachel and the figure of Rachel and the whole business of her tears in a very practical way. And I want to share with you some writing by a theologian, Christian theologian named Christopher Morse, who teaches at Union Theological Seminary in New York and has a pretty new book out, 1994, book from Trinity Press International entitled Not Every Spirit, subtitle A Dogmatics of Christian Disbelief. And it's a whole book on the things you don't have to believe anymore if the gospel is true. I can't give you the whole, or it's inappropriate to go into the whole program here. But one of the biblical characters that Morse uses as a paradigm for his theology of disbelief, or dogmatics of disbelief, is Rachel. Here's a principle which she, and I'll share other things in a moment, which she exemplifies. The Christian faith, in acknowledging the sovereign claiming of human life by God, refuses to acknowledge any claim upon human life which violates that claim of God. Such refusal is the disbelief of Christian faith. Nowhere do we see this refusal more graphically portrayed in the Bible than when the issue of false hope is at stake. And the figure whom he finds to be most appropriate as an example of this, as a faithful witness, as a witness of faithful disbelief, is Rachel. And he tells her story in somewhat the same way that I have. And then he sums up as follows about this. As biblically viewed, the story of Rachel tells us that there are situations in which only God may speak of hope. For there is a hope that only God can give. Who can give hope to a slave or exile and make that captive see freedom in the air when there is none on the ground? Who can give hope when innocent children become the victims of the evils of nature and history? For anyone to speak cheaply and glibly about hope in the midst of such evil is certainly to utter blasphemy. Rachel refuses all consolation. This the biblical testimonies recognize and respect. Rachel refuses to be comforted. Yet the word comes to her in her refusal, "There is hope for your future." The word comes through Jeremiah, suggesting there must be a God of Rachel somewhere. He then speaks of the Matthew text and continues as follows. No explanation is given in the scriptures, either of, and he's referring now to the scriptures of Rachel losing her life in childbirth, of the slaughter of the people in Jeremiah's day, and the slaughter of the innocents in surrounding the birth of Jesus. No explanation is given in these scriptures to the question of why, despite all her resistance, such suffering, injustice, and oppression afflict Rachel in places on this earth. No answer to why evil lays claim to innocent children. What Rachel does is refuse all false comfort and facile explanation. She refuses to be consoled. And by her inclusion, this refusal is honored in the gospel as a faithful testimony. In the darkness surrounding Rachel, just as much as in the light surrounding the natal star, the birthplace of Christ is revealed. At the nativity, a manger somehow adjoins her tomb. And of this, her disbelief of all consolation, not of God, becomes the faithful witness. Her voice, so Jeremiah tells us, is the one God hears. In pondering these texts, Martin Luther saw in Rachel the gospel's link between the Nativity and Good Friday. In the God-forsakenness of God's own Son on the cross, the promised hope for Rachel is embodied. By not believing any consolation short of God's own descent into hell in Christ, the refusal of Rachel becomes a faithful witness pointing to the resurrection. From the perspective of resurrection faith, both the credulity that seeks comfort in false hope and the cynicism that says there is no hope that can be trusted in the manger adjoining Rachel's tomb are revealed as not to be believed. Let me just summarize that again. The credulity that seeks comfort in false hope and cynicism that says there is no hope are both revealed as not to be believed in the story of Rachel. Wherever we find today the credulity willing to believe anything comfortable that passes itself off as spirituality or God talk, and wherever we find today the cynicism that says there is no hope or faith worth trusting, Rachel's refusal becomes a most timely witness to a resurrection faith. So he will launch out then into a theology which in which he finds warrant to disbelieve cheap hope, as well as the cynicism of hopelessness. A couple more things from these things I've been reading, and then I want to pose this as a practical matter in the time we have left. Dresner refers to some ways that various kinds of literature and other sources have picked up on the racial theme. And one of the people he cites is Camus, who wrote something that I had never run into before. Camus is trying to describe in one of his writings the sadness that Jesus must have felt, realizing, or, you know, once he came to know the story of the innocents who had died in the at the time of near his birth. And Camus wrote about that story in Matthew 2 as follows. "And as for that sadness that can be felt in Jesus' every act, wasn't it the incurable melancholy of a man who heard night after night the voice of Rachel weeping for her children and refusing all comfort? The lamentation would rend the night. Rachel would call her children who had been killed for him, and he was still alive." And of course, as he goes on to say, there was no question ultimately but that he must give his own life. And then finally, there's a wonderful treatment here that I'm not going to go into deeply, but I might read a couple quotes. Some of you will surely remember that there's a ship in the novel Moby Dick named Rachel. And that Rachel is the ship that always ends up collecting the the strays who have been dumped overboard and whatnot. And in there's a couple of quotes here. Rachel is this whaling ship whose captain boards the Pequod and pleads for help in searching for lost sailors, among them his own son, only to be ordered from the ship by the austere Ahab. And so the two whalers part and proceed on their separate ways, with the Rachel lurching and heaving on the heavy seas. And then here's the quote. "By her still halting course and winding woeful way, you plainly saw that this ship that so wept with spray still remained without comfort. She was Rachel, weeping for her children, because they were not." And then in the epilogue to the novel, in which Ishmael describes the sole survivor of the disaster of the sinking, tells of his own miraculous being saved. "So floating on the margin of the ensuing scene and in full sight of it, when the half-spent suction of the sunk ship reached me, I was then but slowly drawn towards the closing vortex, till the coffin life buoy, shot lengthwise from the sea, fell over and floated by my side. Buoyed up by that coffin for almost one whole day and night, I floated on a soft and dirge-like mane. The unharming sharks, they glided by as if with padlocks on their mouths. The savage seahawks sailed with sheathed beaks. On the second day, a sail drew near, nearer, and picked me up at last. It was the devious cruising Rachel, that in her retracing search after her missing children, only found another orphan." Okay. I want to give a couple suggestions of what I think we can learn about having the feast to come nearer to our own day. From this story, or from this whole tradition about Rachel. And in sum, I think these points are as follows. I think that we need to get beyond blame in facing tragedy, and we need to make places in our culture for tears. Now, let me explain those a bit. Ever since I've been doing this stuff on Rachel, I've been trying to watch how our culture handles tragedies. And it seems to me that the wisdom of this Rachel tradition exposes the fact that we, like I guess most every culture, jump immediately after any tragedy to figuring out whose fault it is, so that we can somehow or another blame the guilty parties, thus thinking we can protect ourselves by once having fixed responsibility, we can preclude such things in the future. I mean, that's the closest I can come to why we have to play this game. Oklahoma City was almost a prime example. Within moments, we were blaming people indiscriminately, you know, at first. It must have been Middle Eastern characters. But we blamed and blamed and blamed for several days. Finally, we did have some funerals on TV. And finally, we got to see weeping people. But that was kind of irregular. That was not the normal way. I live near Chicago, which means that my newspapers almost every week at least carry stories of children being shot, either by each other or, you know, by adults, stray bullets and whatnot. And every week, therefore, we have the ritual of our public voices blaming guns, saying, no, it's not guns, it's failed social and family system. No, it's not that, it's this. No, it's not that, it's this. Blame, blame, blame. But do we ever get to see the mothers and fathers of these children just weep? You know, what if we had a rule that said, for the first 3 days after every such incident, we will not blame, we'll just sit with the mothers? You know. But it's everywhere. This is one other example, and then I'll throw this open. Some of you may remember a month or so ago there was a major report released by the military on the investigation of the crash on an aircraft carrier that resulted in the death of the first woman fighter pilot. And the initial suggestion of people had been that it was her own relative lack of skill that had resulted in her failure to land that aircraft successfully, and she was killed in the crash. And after the big investigation, they had decided, no, it was not her fault, but rather an engine had failed at a critical moment of the landing, and she was unable to recover despite her best efforts. And so this was a story about blame. This was a story about whose fault it was. But so poignantly, in the middle of this maybe 2 minute segment I heard on National Public Radio, they played the tape of the final moments of her contact with the tower on the aircraft carrier and the controller who was, you know, guiding her in. And this was only a few seconds of tape, and in the first moments, he was saying the usual things that the controllers say, you know, about altitude and this and that. And all of a sudden, he realized something was wrong, and he started to say whatever their code is. I think it was wave off, wave off. And then he said, pull up, pull up, pull up! And you could just hear in his voice the terror that he was feeling at watching his shipmate die. You know, but that was the important part of the story. They just totally ignored that. The important part was, whose fault was this? Who was to blame? You know, and I think the Rachel story and the tradition surrounding it and Morse's work and the Midrashas all teach us that somehow or another we need to learn that there may be a place for blame and for assigning responsibility. But we can't go on without making a space for tears, for the genuine mourning for these things that may be explainable and may be finally solved by assigning blame in some way, but which finally in the human community require that we just sit with the tears and not assign blame and listen. Because if the Midrashas and if the Bible is true, what God listens to is not the blaming, but the purity of the mourning and the examples of not being jealous. Questions or comments, or that's sort of the end of my, I almost feel like I should say amen.
Where did you get that about Rachel crawling in the tent with her sisters?
That's in the Midrash. That's record. A couple different versions of it are in this book, Rachel by Samuel Dresner.
It's interesting. I never heard of that book.
So that means that's a
Midrash,
ancient Midrash from the
3rd
century?
Yeah, it's a fictional Midrash. A Midrash attempts to explain things that are left unexplained. Like, that piece of the Midrash is attempting to explain how in the world could he have slept with the wrong woman and not known it? Yeah. And, you know, there's other pieces of the Midrash, and I chose not to go into them, but why did they just bury her on the road instead of making sure, like everybody else, she got into the ancestral grave at Machpelah, where everybody else was? Because Jacob himself, when he's down in Egypt, says to Joseph, make sure, no matter where I die, that my bones are taken to Machpelah so they can be with my father, but also with Leah. And Joseph doesn't ask, well, Dad, what about my mother? Why is she out on the road? What about getting her bones to Machpelah? And so the Midrash says that it was given to Jacob and Joseph to know that Rachel would need to be out there on the road to weep for the exiles. Now, obviously, that's a fiction, but it's a way to describe how God takes care of these things so that there is a weeper where a weeper needs to be, you know. So these Midrashes, I hasten to add, are fictions, but they are preaching.
Yeah.
They are proclamation.
And your teaching helps us to be present to our own grief and our own sadness. You know, I think that just this time together is a time that, and I'm feeling very much the heaviness and the sadness, and you know that we're sort of honoring. I can feel us honoring our own sadness and the sadness of the centuries. And,
which, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Another tradition that's somewhat like this in Judaism that some of you, I'm sure, know about, is the tradition of the 36, the Lamed Vavniks, the 36 people through whom all the suffering of the world flows. And at any given time in the world, there are 36 people, tzaddiks, righteous ones, who know the suffering of the world. And if it weren't for them, the world would fall apart because the world could not really bear to know the fullness of all the suffering. And those 36, the version of this story that I know best is from Andre Schwarzbart's novel, The Last of the Just, which concludes in a Holocaust scenario. But according to that legend, or that version of the legend of the 36, the suffering of the world makes the hearts of some of these so cold that when they die, it takes God 1,000 years to hold their hearts in God's hand to get them warm. And some of their hearts are so cold that even God's hand cannot get them warmed again. And in honor of those hearts, God turns back the day of judgment by one day.